The other question is, why do we do this? As I was asked once before, why do you have to save all that battlefield land? Can't you just make a movie, a home video, or write a pamphlet, or a book? And that really is a remarkable question, but it's a question that needs to be answered. And Libby said it very well, and that is that it was a defining time in American history. Why don't we start with that? And then why don't we go to the fact that the way that defining time was decided was on the battlefield, where young men poured out their lives and their blood for what they believed in. And then we can go to the fact that the reason it is so defining, or two of the reasons that it is such a defining time in American history, is it settled once and for all two significant questions. The first was, could a state secede from the Union? And that was a fairly debatable item then. And in fact, I would tell you, in my humble opinion, that there is not one of the 13 states that would have entered into the Compact of 1776 or the one in 1789, our Constitution today, there's not one that would have entered it if you'd have told them you could never get out of it. And yet that was the issue that was settled on the battlefield, largely, between 1861 and 1865. And the second issue, of course, was the issue of could one human being own another human being. Slavery was legal. It was sanctioned in law. And once again, as difficult as it may be for us looking back through the prism of the 21st century, it was things that reasonable men could disagree on. And that issue was settled also. And so what was the consequence of settling those two issues at such an enormous cost of human beings and our national treasure? Well, I would suggest to you once again, the consequence has been that this now is the greatest nation in the world. Unarguably one of the greatest nations in the world. Indisputably the oldest democracy in the history of the world. And the one with probably the most freedom in the world. We are, in my opinion, the sum of our history. The first is to remember. Because 2% of all the men and women alive in 1860, that number, over 600,000,
shut the hell up, you right-wing Confederate quack. You talk about how... why do we feel that we need to save the Civil War's battlefield land in America? You know what? I think you need to be more worried about the battlefields that are going to be taking place in America in the next Civil War to come. Then you also babble. The second issue was settled over the issue of slavery during the Civil War, and reasonable men could disagree on slavery. Well, reasonable men who were fascistic, imperialistic, colonialistic, and capitalistic could disagree because basically you're all in the same camp. But those who believe in human justice, well, you got another thing coming there. And it's interesting that you left out the fact that that issue was settled someplace where you guys don't like it to be settled and where it will be settled in the end. It was settled in the battlefield, just like this one will be. You know what time it is. You're listening to 104.1. 101.1 freakradio.org out of Santa Cruz. 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world. And radioforall.net, the universe, slave revolt. Radio time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into couple of segments, one that deals with how liberals are now up in the satellite world, thinking that they're going to make a change there, even though they're saying the same old thing. And a Negro convention on the state of blacks. This is the state of madness. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on a 4.1 slave revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight what we're going to start off with is the Young Turks. Basically with an old script. What I mean is liberals are now supposed to be on some kind of rebound over the airwaves or internet and satellite, you know, with Air America and other things. They're going to reclaim the progressive liberal agenda. Well, there's a satellite show on called The Young Turks. And this is supposed to be with young, enthusiastic, liberal-minded progressives who are ready to take on the right and the status quo. The problem is that in the world of liberalism, you don't really know who's right or not. Because another cat who's sitting right beside you calling himself a liberal can be just as right-wing as David Duke. And this brings up a recent show that they had with Dick Morris. They interviewed Dick Morris. He's the former a campaign advisor for a crime Bill Clinton. He's been a partner of Clinton's for over 20 years. And he's written a book called about the Clintons called Because He Could. He was on the Young Turks. And on this particular episode of the Young Turks program, they discuss politics. So let's examine how this discussion went with the liberals in the satellite world, the Young Turks and Dick Morris. And then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Welcome back to the Young Turks. It's Ben, it's Cenk, it's Michael here, and a very distinguished guest with us in studio for the second time. Political consultant Dick Morris, author of the new book, Because He Could, about Bill Clinton, because nobody can let him go.
he won't let us go. He's running for president for his third term. There's no marriage exemption in the 22nd Amendment.
Let me tell you about if Bill Clinton were running for his third term, that would be fantastic.
Yes. He'd win.
Of course he'd win.
He'd win, and you know what he'd be? Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let me understand something. Obviously, you worked with Bill Clinton for 20 years, and now you seem to, your book and many of your speeches and talks talk about a good deal of criticism of the president. Why the criticism? Why the turnaround?
First of all, my last book, Rewriting History, that I wrote with my wife, I did this one, is a real hit on Hillary, because I do not like Hillary Rodham Clinton, and I do not think she'd be a good president. I thought that her book, Living History, was kind of a facade, an absolute, totally artificial construct.
Tell me why that. Tell me why that is, Mr. Morris.
Well,
I happen to have read the book, start to finish. It was one of the best books I read in the past couple of years.
Then your reading is really terrible.
Well, I don't think it is. I think I'm pretty well read, actually.
And you must absolutely have terrible reading. But the point is, whether it's good or bad, it would sell under fiction. It's got nothing to do with the Hillary Rodham Clinton that exists. But we did this already on your show. When she helped pick the Bill Clinton cabinet, and all she talks about then is how she packed up things to send them to the White House for Chelsea. She talks about she ran the 1982 comeback campaign for Clinton, did a heck of a job at it, and all she can talk about in that book is how she toured Arkansas eating at barbecue joints. But
I think that's my life is not a phony job.
It really is a book that I think offers a real insight into what he's like. But I think that Bill Clinton in domestic policy was one of our truly great presidents. I think that welfare reform is probably the best piece of domestic policy legislation since the Civil Rights Act. Cuts welfare in half, cuts child poverty by a third. Balancing the budget, getting rid of the Cold War debt was an extraordinary accomplishment. And you have got to give him primary credit for the 50% reduction in crime and his anti-crime bill of 94. I think, however, the worst day of Bill Clinton's presidency was September 11, 2001, which occurred 232 days after he had left office.
Can we hold on that for a second?
It's at that date we learned how we would not protect him.
Now you hear Dick Morris. This is some sick stuff. But basically, the liberal partner of crime Bill Clinton, when he has it in for sorry Hillary. Now, Hillary is just as much of a sleazebag as the rest of these little bourgeois politicians, but the reason why he has issues with her, amongst other things, is that he thinks that she's fake. And he says that her book is basically a book of selling fiction. As if the rest of these politicians, as if Boy George and criminals like him are not selling some kind of myth. I mean, Boy George was just a little drugged out crackhead, alcoholic, just a regular bum with a little Bible crammed up his behind. But there's been a whole mythology created about him and his background that, you know, defies belief, except that we have such a gumpified population that they are ready-made entities with such myth-making nonsense in this society. But then Morris goes on to talk about how, you know, he felt that crime bill did good, like the Welfare Act, which was great. And Clinton needed applause for his reduction of crime by 50%, and that came through his anti-crime bill. Now, see, this shows how basically the ideology and the similarity of the Democratic Party and their strategists and the vulturistic Republican Party really merge, because that anti-crime bill was also part of the Effective Death Penalty Act, which made it harder and harder for even innocent people to get a justified hearing. People like Mumia directly affected. It also coincided with the whole anti-terrorism bill and stuff. The whole, you know, war on crime, war on terrorism, effective death penalty, anti-crime, anti-terrorism act was all meshed together, which helped parlay the situation that we're into now. So, crime bill Clinton is interconnected with this whole war on terrorism on an imperial planetary scale. But Dick Morris and the Young Turks up in the satellite world, you know, which is basically where these liberals are headed, this further and further up into the stars, they don't see any problem with this. But Dick Morris sums it up, though, by saying that the one problem that crime Bill Clinton faced was the 9/11/2001 hit that took place long after he had left office. And this was because it proved that we, meaning the U.S. Empire, were not protected. So he's blaming crime Bill Clinton for the 9/11 attacks. Not be, on an imperial planetary scale, because see, Dick Morris, just like the rest of them, in the Republican Party, Boy George, you know, Condoleezza Rice, they're all playing victim. They're pretending like the U.S. was a victim in this, had no part in orchestrating it, had no part in helping create any kind of animosity that may have erupted into this situation. They're all playing whining victims. And Morris is actually trying to lay some of the blame on crime Bill Clinton for the 9/11 hit, saying that Clinton, crime Bill, failed in his job in protecting the U.S. empire properly. See, this helps expose how pathetic these little Democrats, Democrat strategists, liberals really are. They will continue to devour themselves in an imperial contradiction and never really be able to deal with the real questions at hand and the role of the U.S. empire, because they are so embedded with the capitalist class themselves.
Yeah, I'll tell you the truth, Tracy. I've never heard this particular speaker, and I was trying to get some coherence out of his thoughts, but I was kind of lost until he started going over his support for the most reactionary measures that Clinton actually took on. And remember now, the death penalty, the Effective Death Penalty Act, is a part of Crime Bill's Omnibus Anti-Terrorism Act and Bill. As Tracy said, it's all tied together. And what that did was make it very difficult for innocent people to prove their innocence, because the bill states that federal judges are not to challenge the findings of fact of state judges.
Now, next, the Young Turks talk about jobs, the economy, and the war on terror with Dick Morris. So let's see how this plays out. Check it out.
Guard. But let's finish off domestic policy first, and maybe eventually we'll get back to Hillary as well. Domestic policy, as you just said, Bill Clinton did a fantastic job. And under this president, we've had a disastrous turn of events. We've had 800,000 jobs lost when Clinton gained 22 million jobs in 8 years. We've had a $271 billion surplus that Bill Clinton left for him turned into a $413 billion deficit. So how can you present...
Let's have one. If you want to regurgitate all the Kerry talking points everybody's heard from the debate, everybody understands.
You know where we can get those Kerry talking points?
The United States with 5.3% unemployment. The important thing was to try to hold the 22 million jobs that were created under the Clinton administration.
But they didn't.
Which was extraordinary. Yeah, they held all but 700,000 of them.
You're an expert campaigner. Do you think that's a good thing to campaign on, Mr. Morris?
If you can allow me to talk or not. If you don't allow me to talk, I'll leave, okay? I want to be able to say what I'm going to say. If you want to interview me, fine. You want to give me a speech, I'll shut up and listen to you, okay? When you create 22 million jobs, and you lose 2 million because of bin Laden and the attack in the airplane industry, and then you regain 1.5 million, and you're going to get the remaining 700,000 back, probably by February. It's not a disaster. John Kerry, I think, would be a better president than George Bush on domestic policy.
Okay.
I think he'd do a better job on health care. I think he'd do a better job on the economy. Much better job on the environment, for this reason. Probably a better job on education. Probably a better job on Social Security. I think Bush would do a better job than Kerry on the war on terror, foreign policy, and containing terrorism.
Well, I think it's crucial, obviously, that we talk about that, because that's what this campaign is being run on. And let's be honest, thank goodness, that's what this campaign ought to be run on, since that's the most pressing issue facing the country. I'll give you an easy one, because I'm mystified by this argument, but I'm anxious to hear you make it. Why would George Bush do a better job on terrorism and protecting
his
country?
Because there's a fundamental difference of opinion between Clinton, Gore, and Kerry on the one hand, and Bush on the other. Both are very focused on terror. Both understand how important it is. But the Democrats tend to approach the war on terror the same way that they approach the war on drugs, which is lots of money, lots of resources, a vigorous criminal justice effort, a vigorous effort to use proxies like Colombia and other governments like that. But no real understanding of the role that nation states play in the sponsoring of terror. Terrorists are like HIV viruses. They swim in your bloodstream, but they don't make you sick. When they latch onto a cell, they use the DNA of that cell to make you sick. And whether they're the Ba'athist terrorist in Iraq, the Shiite terrorist in Iran, the Saudi royal family, in effect, terrorists, or the Taliban, they use the accoutrements of nationhood, the revenues, the conscript population, export-import trade, foreign currency reserves, all of those, and then they become vastly more powerful than the Medellin cartel. They become something that can, in fact, destroy us.
Look, those seem like great points, and you sound like you have an understanding of what the needs to fighting terrorism are. I see no indication at all that anybody doesn't understand that. What is your evidence that John Kerry doesn't get that?
Well, for example, in his Times interview a week ago Sunday, he said, as a former law enforcement official, I believe we have to go after them the same way we went after drugs. And then Holbrooke, who's his likely Secretary of State, who's normally very good, I liked him in the Clinton White House, said that the war on terror is a metaphoric war in the same sense as the war on drugs. Saddam Hussein didn't attack us on 9/11, but Adolf Hitler didn't attack us on December 7th either. And Bush understood.
But Adolf Hitler was allied with Japan, and Saddam Hussein was not allied with the people who attacked
him. Saddam Hussein was allied with the anti-American terrorists all over the world.
Where is that? That's the first time I think you've...
They trained him.
How did they train him? They didn't train them at all.
And in any case... Even if there were no alliance, the idea that you needed to destroy all of the fascist regimes, Mussolini, who was not allied with them, but we declared war on him anyway, all of the fascist regimes in World War II, you similarly now have to go through all of the seven nations that Bush, Clinton, and Bush all have listed as sponsors of terror. And you've got to get rid of those regimes. Now, sometimes you can flip them, like we did in Libya, and like we're looking at doing in the Sudan. Sometimes you can intimidate them by a robust U.S. presence next door that I think we're doing in Syria. Sometimes you can influence them, like I think we're beginning to do in Saudi Arabia. And sometimes you can topple them by domestic means as a result of a presence next door, like I hope we do in Iran.
All right.
But the point is, you've got to go one regime at a time and do that.
See, now it becomes clearer and clearer how anyone who gets caught up in the Democratic Party is basically caught in the tornado of imperial perpetuation and intervention, because the Democratic Party, their advisors like Dick Morse, are embedded within the imperial structure. So at the end of the day, all of your fantasies about lesser of two evil concepts and pulling the Democrats to the left are going to be lost in vain. So here you see these young Turks up in the stars, in the satellite area, trying to talk to Morris. Now, the young Turks themselves have this liberal fantasy of the world and, you know, how things go. Morris is also basically just a right-wing imperial demagogue. And they just get caught up in a tornado that basically resolves around, how do I get my imperial candidate elected? And what are his strengths and weaknesses? So Morris's argument is that the Democrats approach a war on terror like they approach a war on drugs. Lots of money, using governmental resources and things of that nature. Yet they have no understanding of how the nation state plays into terrorism. Now, this war on terrorism that Boy George has engulfed the world in has cost this country billions of dollars. What's he talking about? I mean, Boy George has used money in a way for his imperial endeavor unlike any other president in history. So to try to get into this thing that is a Democrat versus Republican thing, and the Republicans are more efficient at a war on terror, which at the end of the day is nothing but a war on the planet for its resources construct, is basically to miss the whole point and to basically harangue yourself on these pseudo technicalities. is completely false. The this administration has used this government in a big government, big brother, fascistic at times way, as far as some of the rights that they have stripped away within its and on its own citizens. Yet this is the same party that is supposed to be callous towards big government and big government intervention. This is the label that Morris was slapping on the Democrats as a fault of them not knowing how to fight. Now, a war on terrorism properly. This is all a farce. This imperial class needs to, because of how it's structured in an imperial financial way, it needs to go up and gobble up other people's resources and stranglehold for its own pathetic existence the resources under the feet of other human beings and strangle them out of existence like a vampire sucking the blood, the last drop of blood out of a child for its own preservation, just as ruthlessly. And it has nothing to do with a Democrat or Republican. They're just Igors kidnapping the kids and the people to bring to Dracula their master. So this is just hocus pocus talk. Then he gets into this rhetoric about Kerry being better domestically, Boy George is better on foreign policy. These episodes that you see going on in Syria and all of that is taking place by a class that is trying to maintain its power. An administrator for that ruling class, whether he or she be a Democrat or Republican, makes no difference. They're just administrators for the ruling class. So, of course, in typical fashion, the Turks and Morris get into this nuanced thing about, well, Adolf didn't attack the U.S. during World War II. It was the Japanese. Yet, Sam declared war on Adolf. Of course, they're leaving out large chunks of history. How Hitler rose to power. How the U.S. Corporate engine was behind Adolf because they wanted him to bludgeon down the working class into place in Germany, which was rising up strong. So there was a consensus from Henry Ford all the way to IBM to Standard Oil, who was showing them the Nazis how to convert other energy fuel into aviation fuel, all the way down the line, General Electric. They were all behind Adolf because they realized that this is a class against class. Once Adolf was able to smash up his disposable people, i.e. the working class, then of course on a more ruling class level, the ruling class are willing to duke it out amongst themselves to see who holds the breadbasket of the world empire, who holds the mantle of the world empire. And they're willing to submit the planet into millions of casualties to maintain their power and to see who comes out at top on top. But when it came down to how Germany was going to evolve, there was a consensus amongst the ruling class to back Adolf all the way down the line. So to get into this whole thing about Hitler being, you know, the ultimate enemy, that's the kind of game they love to play, leaving out large chunks of the fact that they were as deeply behind Hitler when it served their purposes as they were behind bin Laden when it served their purposes, shows the class disconnect that these imperial criminals reside in.
Oops.
and the Three Stooges who were trying to misrepresent history. Just a side point on what Tracy just mentioned, people should always know one of the reasons that Henry Ford, and another reason that Henry Ford and a section of the American bourgeoisie was supporting Hitler was because they were hoping he would overthrow Stalin. They were hoping that the Germans would overthrow and destroy the Soviet Union. And in fact, the Communist Party in America used to call for the United States to open up a second front to distract Hitler so that he could help, so that, you know, he couldn't concentrate all his forces on Russia. What really happened? Stalingrad. That's what happened. The United States did not open up a second front in Europe. And then the Russians defeated Hitler, and his Waterloo was Stalingrad. And at that point, it didn't matter because everything was downhill for the Germans after their terrible defeat they suffered in Stalingrad. Now, Tracy done went and stole the thunder from me. Tell me, what does this mean? Clinton created 22 million jobs. Is Clinton a capitalist that hires people and puts them to work? What does it mean when they say this kind of jargon? It's empty, foolish jargon. Jobs are created by capitalists, not loudmouth politicians. All right? And it's the economy as a whole that creates an environment that allows the job to come into existence, not a single president. Now, Mr. Dick Morris does, as Tracy said, talk about how Kerry would do good with the domestic, but then Bush is going to do better with the debt. So I guess we should have a little hybrid creature and cut them in half and have half Kerry. This is foolishness. But what this does show is that this Morris cat, this so-called Democratic Party advisor, you have just heard with your own ears that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. From his perspective, this is not Tracy and I going on about it here. You heard it from the horse's mouth. Thank you.
And it's also kind of comical to listen to the so-called alternative fraction, meaning the Young Turks out in satellite land, as they themselves are spun around in circles in an imperial argument with an imperial colleague. This is the alternative that the liberals have to this is the alternative that they have to offer. Man. Now next, the Young Turks and Dick Morris debate over the guideline to imperial expansionism. We'll see their guideline concept.
You talked about in World War II, we had to attack Hitler even though he didn't attack us. But Hitler, as Ben pointed out, was allied with Japan. Another terrible government
Hitler
that
also,
was...
Hitler also declared war on us.
Yeah, but you
right.
have any doubt
but
that
hold...
FDR would have declared war on Hitler even if he had not declared war
But
on
what
Hitler.
I do have
I
a doubt about...
He would have wanted to. It would have been a little tricky, but he would have wanted to.
Okay, now what I do have a doubt about is terrible governments that were in existence at the same time as we got attacked by Pearl Harbor, Russia and China. If we had attacked China and Russia at the same time as fighting World War II and the Axis, I think that would have been a disastrous course. But yet, that seems to be what's happening now. Iraq and Al-Qaeda, not allied. Iraq bad, Al-Qaeda bad. Let's go after Iraq and distract ourselves from Al-Qaeda.
There's a list that was formulated in 1990 by Bush Sr., ratified and used as the guide by Bill Clinton, enacted it by Congress as the guideline for American aid and immigration policy of seven countries that are judged sponsors of terrorism. North Korea, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, and the Sudan. I'm not making those up.
But
there should be an eighth, which is Saudi Arabia.
But in 19...
So here you hear him again. He's going down his list of countries, basically countries that were scripted out by the U.S. that says that they are terrorists or terrorist sympathizers, i.e. bad countries. And within his whole frame of work as a Democrat, Democrat supporter, Democratic advisor for a crime Bill Clinton for 20 years, that gives the U.S. empire, out of its own interest, a right to topple their governments. This is a perpetuation of imperialism. So, the issue that the Young Turks have with Morris is not so much about the right of a country, the U.S., going in and destroying the sovereignty of another country and invading other countries in violation of international law. That's not the problem that the Young Turks. It's a strategic issue that the Young Turks have with Morris. Is it feasible to do that, i.e. to take on the world at the same time? So as you heard one Turk say, that if the U.S. Empire were to have attacked China and Russia at the same time during World War II, after the attacks by Japan in an occupied zone of Hawaii, occupied by the U.S., by Sam, then that would have been disastrous. In other words, the issue of other countries' sovereignty is not really an issue with these imperial liberals. It's just that, is it in our best interest to use our imperial machinery anytime we feel that we are quote-unquote threatened or under the gun of our enemies? And when I say under the gun, I don't mean literally, because it's not like Saudi Arabia and all of these countries that Morris was naming off were sailing their ships over into California or anything. It's just this vague type of, these guys are sponsoring terrorism or these guys are threats. No proof whatsoever on the ground. And all of the facts lead to the fact that the U.S. is the greatest purveyor of terrorism on the planet, from its School of the Americas facilities to it being found guilty of international terrorism when the people of Nicaragua took Sam to court for its backing, funding, and training of the terrorist squad known as the Contras. Blood all on Sam's hand. Here's a country that invaded Panama, that set up the North Wood documents, which were basically to create a facade of being under attack to justify its own imperialist invasion and attack, its terroristic attack, on sovereign countries like Cuba. This is how wicked this society is, how ruthless it is. It invaded Iraq against international law. This made it up. And when the international community basically looked at Sam as if he was a madman, Sam looked him right back in the eye saying, yes, I am, but I got these mad bullets, depleted uranium and otherwise, to back me up, and stomped on in. I mean, this is insane to believe that these liberals up in satellite land have any kind of alternative and offer any kind of alternative when the best that they can do is get into these fake debates with another imperial liberal, i.e. Dick Morris. Now next, here's where Zionism starts to emerge amongst these participants, especially Morris, as they go back and forth about which way and who should and when should Sam back his so-called allies. Check this out.
1990, something changed between 1990 and 1991 in regards to Iraq, meaning that their influence in the world around them, in the entire world, was completely minimized by our efforts in the Gulf War.
Tell that to the suicide bombers in Israel who got $25,000 per family.
Israel has
blowing up.
Israel has a beef with Saddam.
Israel has a beef with the country. We do too.
Well, that's, I think, patently ridiculous. We're not a sponsor and a proxy for Israel. We're the United States of America. We were attacked on 9/11 by Al-Qaeda, and we should have gone after Al-Qaeda, not fought Israel's wars for them after 9/11, because that distracts us from our war.
I wonder if your Jewish listeners understand that you don't think the United States should fight Israel's wars for them. I treat them As an ally and as a Jew, I treat them as a bastion of freedom. And unlike you, I think it's very important for the United States to back Israel and support it every chance that it gets.
I don't think Cenk says that's not correct. I'm just saying that by proxy, every single time something happens, we then are somehow forced to. And I'm a Jew, and I, you know, I can separate myself, as I'm sure you can, Mr. Morris, from Israel. But the point that Cenk is making is not the point that you just interpreted that Cenk was making. Cenk is just saying that probably by proxy we are not entitled to nor required to just go along and be with Israel every step of the way.
And also, you know, first of all, big picture view Israel as a bastion of freedom. I'm embarrassed by Israel now as an American Jew.
Well, I'm not embarrassed by it.
Oh,
You're not embarrassed by their occupation of Palestine?
Let me give you a break.
No, do you believe for 5 minutes that if the suicide bombers were not attacking Israel, that Israel would be attacking the PLO settlements?
They've never given any indication that they're ever going to turn that into a real Palestinian state. So would they still be in occupation? Yes, no. They've given every indication they would still be in occupation.
Getting a little far afield because he could.
Well, let me get back to what you just mentioned regarding Israel, back to our support, our fight against Saddam. Brent Scowcroft, I guess over the weekend, National Security Advisor to the first President Bush, his exact quote on the current Bush's policy toward Israel is, Sharon just has him, Bush, wrapped around his little finger. I think the president is mesmerized, indicating that our support of Ariel Sharon and Israel is...
I can understand that you guys seem inclined not to regard it as very serious.
No.
That's ridiculous.
Israelis,
no, that, but that's ridiculous.
Have been killed by Iraqi.
The question is, how do you fight that, Mr. Morris? You know that. The question is, how do you fight it?
The way you fight it is what they're doing. You build a wall where they can't get you. You build a wall that stops them from being able to attack you. And when a regime is sponsoring terror by paying off the suicide bombers $25,000 for each Israeli they can kill, $25,000 a family.
I know, we always say that. I'm curious. I want those, like, checks.
Well, only a small portion of the amount he bribed France and Russia and China not to fight with the United States, but still an enormous amount of money.
The problem isn't the wall, Mr. Morris. The problem is where the wall is built. In fact, on this show, before they even started the wall, we suggested the idea of a wall. The wall is not a bad idea. Separate the Palestinians and the Israelis, and then give the Palestinians their state, which, by the way, Sharon has not decided to do.
And you bring
the wall to the 1967 borders. If you're not willing to do that, you're going to have perpetual war. You claim to be a friend of Israel, Dick Morris, but I don't see it, because if you never give the Palestinians their territory, you are perpetuating an endless war that does not help Israel, but hurts it tremendously.
It's too bad if after 750 suicide bombing attacks on Israelis or 750 Israelis killed, Sharon was not willing to bilaterally negotiate the location of the wall. He was willing to make peace, as was Israel, in 2000 when President Clinton laid a perfectly reasonable peace proposal on the table and offered to pay the PLO $13.5 billion a year to sign that agreement. And Yasser Arafat wouldn't do it because he couldn't do it.
Yasser Arafat,
because that population is committed to war. And the only way to make peace is to do it unilaterally. You can't do it bilaterally.
Well,
Yasser Arafat's
a terrible guy, and I don't know that Sharon actually supported that.
See, now you see how raw, dog, and sick these liberals are. This is them talking amongst themselves. You hear it for yourself. This is not us throwing in our two cents without you hearing their own views and stuff. You have Morris say that the Palestinian population is just committed to war, as if it's just some kind of biological thing within the Arab bloodstream, just to be bloodlust and hungry. So they go back and forth, though, about what to do about it. And you hear the Turks say that they still view, or at least one of them said, that he still views Israel as a bastion of freedom, even though he's embarrassed by some of the things that they're doing. Now, anyone who says that he sees Israel as a bastion of freedom is just someone that is so deeply embedded, consciously or unconsciously, into the imperial overall structure of the world financial military complex that they can never break out on their own. they'll have to be broken out basically of existence, I mean, for to hear this type of rhetoric. But this is someone who's deeply embedded within that construct, so they'll never be able to have any kind of real, decent, honest, forcible debate and argument. Someone who should be able and could be able, if they were halfway historical and honest, to smash someone up like Morris. But instead, Morris is going on about how you stop the attacks as you build the wall around them to stop them, basically to segregate them out and to exterminate them and remove them. It's basically his program. Now, the Turks respond that the wall is not a bad idea, but they have other issues about what's going on. I mean, this shows you how sick these liberals are. The fact that Morris then tried to throw out a threat because these guys were not as conciliatory towards the expansionistic policies of the Israeli government as he liked, and how they didn't feel that every time something happens to Israel or is proposed to happen to Israel, that the U.S. empire is supposed to jump up. Then Morris throws out this little subtle, not so subtle threat about, you know, how do you think Jewish people would feel about it? You know, it turns out that they're all Jewish. The two young Turks that were debating, and Morris is Jewish. They're all Zionists, basically. As they go on and on about how Arafat was a terrorist, they leave out the fact that Sharon is someone who is deeply and has been deeply committed to the art of terrorism. Yet he's the commandeer of the Israeli government at this time. The irony of this is not even spoken about. Now, this makes it clear that these guys aren't about any true human justice. This is just about imperial expansionism and how you use either your politics, liberal, conservative, religious politics, to justify it. This is why I've always connected a lot of the things that are happening in places like Israel with places like the Sudan. It's only flipped over in the Sudan, and the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on in the Sudan are justifying their expansionism through their hocus-pocus trick. The Islam, or turban, the Islam trick. Now, they are just as much of an invader and occupier into the Sudan, which was once Nubia, as the invading forces of Zionism are into Israel. But when you talk to the average Islam, they'll, especially Arab Islam, they'll come with this whole rewriting of history about what's going on in the Sudan, and thereby they end up backing the Khartoum government, the National Islamic Front, who's just as imperialistic, just as expansionistic, just as undemocratic. As a matter of fact, one could argue that they're even more genocidal and undemocratic than the wretched government in Israel. These guys recently have 400,000 hearts out of the people's body because they've turned them into bones in the Sudan, and they haven't blinked an eye over it. Over the last 20 years, they've helped evaporate 2 million plus people because of their imperial expansionist neo-capitalist goals, and how they've used their religion and other things to hocus-pocusize their population with this kind of Arabic identity stuff. Well, this shows how sick those who are chauvinistic and nationalistic can be in their truest form, and how at the end of the day, they offer no real alternative to a decent humanity in the future for the masses of people.
You know what? I just have one thing to say at this point, and that is, to measure how silly and delusional the host of this program really is, these hosts are, they said on the program, they said some foolishness that they had advocated that Israel should build a wall, as if their silly program was the source of the Israeli apartheid wall. These people are self-delusional, man. This is madness.
Now, next, the Turks and Moors get into what can only be described in part as some kind of convoluted debate over some of these political issues. So let's see what they have to say as they sail off into the sunset or into the satellite dark matterism. Check it out.
You talk about how Saddam attacked, you know, paid the $25,000 for the suicide bombers that attacked Israel. But how does Saddam attack America in the last 12 years? He didn't. So now we go after a guy that has distracted us when we have much bigger things to worry about. Now you talk about state-sponsored terrorism, but Al-Qaeda, other than Afghanistan, which we wiped out and correctly wiped out, is not state-sponsored. To this day, they are not state-sponsored. So I don't know why you think that we should... Do you think the Sudan and Syria and Iran is...
Did I hear you say that Al-Qaeda was not state-sponsored? What the hell do you think?
I said in Afghanistan they were, and we wiped them out. Today, they are not state-sponsored. Do you believe they're state-sponsored today, Dick Morris?
No, of course not. But I thought you said they weren't.
And they were not sponsored by Iraq as well, which is another state.
The point is, seven regimes that sponsor terrorism. And if you had any experience with American foreign policy, as I've had for 20 years, you would understand that the Democrats and the Republican Party both understand the necessity of toppling those regimes. Bill Clinton did everything he possibly could to oust Saddam Hussein from power. He failed to do so, in part because he was disempowered during the second term by the impeachment nonsense. But the point is that it should come as no surprise that the United States took advantage of the mobilization of American public opinion to accomplish what has been a national goal of American foreign policy for 15 years, which was to get rid of that regime. And to get rid of Libya, which we flipped, Sudan, which we flipped,
okay,
Syria,
we're
trying to destabilize, and Iran, which if we succeed in Iraq,
we
will
Sudan?
Be able to... Yeah, they're terrorizing their own people, but they're no longer international sponsors of terror.
Well, we were able to participate in the North-South peace, but that has not led to anything but problems between the East and West.
There are no allegations that they're sponsoring international terror. They're committing genocide against their people, and the United States is fighting a lonely battle in the Security Council.
I don't think we waved the American flag high about that.
The U.S. is fighting a lonely battle in the Security Council to get military action and heavy sanctions against the Sudan over the opposition of France and Russia and Germany.
We're talking to Dick Morris, author of Because He Could, about Bill Clinton.
I do have to get going, but I have enjoyed being with you guys. And if you read up a little bit, maybe you'll know enough to be able to do a better interview next time.
Yeah, please. I mean, if you knew a little bit more, Mr. Morris, perhaps you wouldn't talk about state-sponsored terrorism when Iraq was not a state sponsor of Al-Qaeda, and you know that.
All right,
but nonetheless, you know, you keep talking about this neocon nonsense that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So he's now, I would like to point out, he's not only left the studio now, he has walked to the elevator. There were some complaints the last time that we talked to Dick Morris. They weren't tough enough on it. I don't think we're going to get any calls.
No.
That was tough on Dick Morris? I mean, basically, they were just going back and forth on who's right and when is it right for imperial interventions and stuff. But it was all within the spectrum of ruling class, capitalist acceptability. This shows you how sick, I mean, ruthlessly sick things are. And the same way that these demagogues can basically fuss over various nuanced issues concerning when is it right and not right within the concept of Sam's imperial interest to invade sovereign nations, is the same way they have and will be debating when, where, and why is it strategically right to undermine the basic fundamental rights of people within this society. See, these are the type of demagogues that can see a brown shirt wave this take over and engulf the landscape of America. And while they're off in satellite land in the sky somewhere, they would be blinking and fussing over some technicality issues of when is it acceptable to burn up the little raggedy Constitution and when is it not. Meanwhile, the gas ovens would be going on in this country. To depend on them is basically to depend on, you know, Goofy or Mickey Mouse or Underdog to come to your rescue as salvation in this society, or Jesus or Muhammad or whoever. I mean, this is, it's time to face the real world for what it is. Only a form of class-conscious solidarity with other people who are within the same and are in the same conditions that you are is going to be your salvation. Clinton did everything he could to oust Saddam, states Dick Morris. Now, of course, within this construct, he's not challenged by the fact that Crime Bill Clinton has 1 million plus corpses laying in his bed, half of whom at least were Iraqi kids through the efforts of his sanctions. This is a mad dog. And as time goes on, historically speaking, historians are going to write about this period in astonishment, in the same way that they write about the astonishing liquidation of the Indian population in America, the indigenous Australian Aborigine population in Australia, large portions of the population in Africa, like the Congo and the Sudan, and so on and so forth, the liquidation of European Jewry and others in Europe, and so on and so forth. And these guys have no basic humanistic class-conscious way of debating these issues, because at the end of the day, they're all in Sam's shoe. Well, it's time for those shoes to get a foot in to squash them all.
You know what? I want to... I found this particular clip that we're dealing with absolutely nauseating, but in the real world, you got to deal with this stuff, because this is the real world. You know, this is the Democratic Party. Thank you, Mr. Dick Morris, political advisor for Bill Clinton, for just saying what really is true, that both the Democrats and the Republicans want to prosecute the war on terrorism, attack Iraq, etc., etc. He made it abundantly clear. And therefore, who then, in their right mind, would offer the Democratic Party as a serious opposition to Bush after hearing this madness? Think about it.
Hold on a sec. All right, you know what time it is now. Shameless file time. And next, what we're going to deal with is Travis Smalley's Black Union Summit. Actually, Travis Smalley's Black Union Summit, as you'll hear, is basically a travesty of black leadership. A contract on black America. Because they got a contract out on us. Smiley recently had a conference. It was on C-SPAN. And it dealt with the black agenda and black leadership's role on this agenda and the state of the union of black folks. You could actually check it out on the internet. Just go to the Slave Revolt blog, this Slave Revolt Radio on your Google web, and then go to the not to the radio section where you'll see all the different shows that we have, but look on your left-hand side where it says Slave Revolt blog, and check out the little piece that it has on Travis Smiley, and then you can actually click in and go right to C-SPAN and watch on watch the whole little thing, or as much as you can tolerate. You wouldn't be able to watch. It's over 4 hours, so just take as much as you can if you care to. And actually, after you check that out, because it'd be good to also go to on the Slave Revolt blog, some of the links or actually the videos that are on the blog, and check out Malcolm's debate. Malcolm is on there. There's a number of videos, over 50, 60 videos you can check out. And all you have to do is just click right on. But Malcolm has is in a debate with a number of civil rights leaders in the early 60s. And check out how that debate went and how Malcolm conducted himself in this debate compared to what you're about to hear amongst these Negro leaders. There's Sharpton, Cornel West, Farrakhan, Jesse Jackson, all of them participated in this current Black Summit type thing. We're going to get started on this whole contract and see how it plays itself out. So let's check out what these guys have to say and let's take it from there. Dig this.
In that regard, I'll start with you, Dr. West. What do you make of the notion, the viability, the practicality, the very idea of a so-called contract with Black America? Am I pipe dreaming? Is it possible? Can we do something here? What do you make of it?
Well, the boys used to say we've got to do something. And we got to be clear about what the starting point is. The starting point is there's too much black social misery in the world and in the country. Too many folks suffering ought not to be suffering. So we got to keep the focus there. Then the question becomes, how do we get clarity of vision, quality of service, but preserve our sense of history? Because the present is history. And you're looking at history. Look at the quality of spokesperson on this stuff. Look at this. Look at this. Thanks to this brother right here. But the issue's bigger than us. And the question is, how do we bring together the political leadership that's courageous, the spiritual leadership that knows how to speak to issues of death and dread and despair, and the economic leadership that knows how to engage in entrepreneurial creativity, and then the ordinary folk with all of their riches and their unbelievable creativity and the music and what have you. So we need a division of labor. We got to respect each other enough that we accent the different geniuses and contributions that we make so our egos don't get in the way of the struggle of the people.
You and I both love sports, and because I live in L.A., I know this all too well, that if you're going to win the NBA championship, you need a good inside game and a good outside game. And since Shaq ain't in town no more, we ain't going to win in L.A. this year. I can guarantee you that. That said, because you need a good inside and outside game, Dr. West, on the outside, if you will, in academia, you decided to go on the inside this last time around, I said respectfully, as a presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket. Tell me what you make now, having run for president, of the notion, the idea of a contract with Black America. What do you make of the idea?
Well, I think that before we can honestly talk about a contract with Black America, we need to have contact with each other. I think that the real problem is that not enough of us are talking to each other. And if we had unity among the leadership around the things that we can agree, we don't have to agree on everything.
Yeah.
But if we came together on what we agreed on, then we could force a contract with America because we have a contact and an honor among ourselves. But we can't ask others to give us the respect we don't give each other. I think that's the first problem. I mean, the reality is we are here 40 years after the Pettus Bridge March, which brought us to where we could have elected officials. We're here 40 years after Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed. We're here 10 years after the Million Man March. We had more contact 10 and 40 years ago than we do now. I don't have to agree with everything Bishop Long does, but he built this campus. We need to talk about that. Minister Farrakhan brought 2 million men together. Why are we not in contact with each other? Why we can then go to this American public and leadership and make demands. Look at our conditions. While we run around here soundbiting and ego tripping, our people are suffering. They need us in touch with each other.
I don't know about this. This does, in fact, make clear the crisis in leadership. First of all, it's when you listen to Sharpton, Sharpton's a very eloquent gentleman, so is West. But what have they actually said here, if you listen very carefully? Sharpton talking about we have to overcome ego, as if that were the central problem. Clearly, it makes no sense. Is that the only problem? If these guys got a hold of their egos, then everything would be okay? What are you talking about? Stay in touch. So what do you think? You're supposed to pick up the phone? What's happening, Farrakhan? What do you think? We should take state power this weekend? Well, what's up? Yeah, well, you know, like, maybe we just go in there. What are you talking about, Stan? We need organization that speaks to our objective interest. That means we need new leaders, is what we need. Leaders that are committed to building organizations that can lead us in political combat with our enemies. Now, my goodness, what are we talking? We're talking housing. What are they talking about? We're talking jobs. What are they talking about? We're talking about defending our interests up and down the line. What the hell are they talking about here? In fact, Farrakhan's talking about a new million man march. That's what he's talking about. And this time, it's going to be a 10 million man march. I think the guy done slipped and hit his head on a chair or something, or a table or something, when he's going out there. I can't stop and think about this, y'all. How many black people are in America? Let's say 40 million. All right, well, whatever it is. Whatever it is, you know, I don't have a census. But let's say, you know, how are we going to get 10 million people at a demonstration or a march in Washington? Think about that just for a minute, the dynamics of that. And this is a person that's offering himself up for leadership. Before you even think about that, think about the last Million Worker March. And what did we actually accomplish? Besides, of course, the accomplishment of bringing more than a million black men together, if that's your expectation level, I can understand that. But from a political standpoint, where was the victory?
Once again, a lot of this is just posture politics. When you look at a lot of the things that are actually going on, what is kind of comical on a certain level when you hear and see some of these politicians whine about what's going on in poor areas and how the poor areas have not taken on their responsibilities to, you know, further, quote unquote, their cause. When you look at what's, look at this honestly, here you have a population where a core component of it has had a counterintelligence program thrust upon it, followed by waves of economic attacks, redlining by the banking institutions, attacks by the police in all forms. Where in LA you have the Wayside Whiteys, the Vikings, the Cavemen, follow through with the Rampart Division, where it comes out that 100 plus black people and Latinos have been unjustifiably framed up. Where were these black leaders, so-called leaders, in setting any kind of cohesive agenda? The Mullen Commission report shows in New York how the police had institutionalized racism and attacks on black people. Where was any kind of coalition building on that issue? You take a trip down to Chicago and you see Burge actually torturing black people in his dungeons. Nothing being done. Black people just left out in the wilderness. At the same time, the schools are under fierce attack. Privatization, closing down. You have many schools that don't even have heat in them. The little kids are just freezing in them. Holes in the wall, holes in the ceiling. Whatever elements are existing outside, those are what you're going to have to deal with within the school system. It's clear that this society, by and large, has no room or place for a large portion of its black population. This then gets followed through with a war on drugs, a fierce attack that intentionally targets large portions of the black population for nothing more than incarceration and extermination, a ruthless program thrown out, where you see some of the most vile entities and vile techniques take place in the black community to break the black community down. And in the midst of all of this madness and viciousness, spatial deconcentration and other things, you see that at least 60%+ of the black population, when this war in Iraq was about to break out, look over at Iraq, look at the machinery of the U.S. empire and still maintain its own humanity and say, no, this is wrong. Still look at the interest of other people and a common thread of other people's right for existence to as something that should be shared and looked favorably upon. The majority of black people in this country are not Muslims. They don't share that with the Iraqi people. The majority of the Iraqi people are not black. You do have, you know, a small fraction of black people who were left over from the Zanj rebellion, you know, the Arab Islamic slave trade, and black populations that moved over there to actually work, you know, in the oil field and stuff like that. But the overwhelming population, of course, in Iraq is Arab. So there's no racial connection. There's no connection on nationality. There's no connection on religion. But black people in this country still see the right and the humanity in Iraqi people and still realize that a mother crying in the streets of West Oakland over a lost kid is no different than a mother crying in the streets of Iraq over a kid that has been blown up. Yet, how is the response of America and many of these Negro leaders for black people in this country still holding on to its humanity and recognizing the dignity of other people. We end up getting attacked. The Cosbys and other coons come out and marshal out diatribes about our lack of morality. Yet, here is an empire, and a majority of its citizens, white citizens in particular, who were for this immoral, barbaric act. Yet, the people who have their morality called into question are the people who've been under the most fierce and barbaric act, and who still retain some kind of consciousness and connection with other human beings that they've never even come across. This is the type of savagery that we see going on. And in the real world, this is something that can and will be tapped into. But when you hear this type of diatribe going on, obviously it's not going to be tapped in by these types who see that at the end of the day, when they're pulling levers for Democrats and Republicans and what have you, and for McDonald's and other corporations that are basically plundering the planet, that at the end of the day, they can't pull the lever for support for the masses of black people because their interests are in contradiction to it. Now, next, Dr. Lowry goes into how black people need a convent, not a contract. Amongst themselves for spiritual reasons. Let's check out what these guys are actually saying. Check this out.
To put together a contract of the thing that we believe in, where is the plan and how responsible is leadership to making that happen?
Unfortunately, one time out of me, I do agree with that. Takes a long time to agree with each other. I agree with that. She's growing. Let me say very seriously that I like the idea of the contract with America, except I'd like to nominate another term. Covenant. Rather than contract.
All right.
Because covenant introduces a spiritual, moral context. And I think that's our problem, that we have let other folks take the moral high ground. When the moral high ground was our status, that's how we turned back growling dogs and cow prods and lynch mobs and jail. We translated jails into prayer cells. Because we had the moral high ground. We've got to now recapture that spirituality that gave us the strength. We have deserted the good spouse of spirituality. And we're shacking up with the prostitute of materialism and greed. We've got to have... We've got to have a new birth of spirituality. Because that's our strength. Our strength is not in the Republicans who take, you know, not a Democrat. One takes it for granted, the other one just takes it. Our power is in the Creator and in each other. That's a spiritual issue. We need to have a revival of spirituality. And when we catch on fire, and when we see God moving in us and in each other, we can set America on fire. We can have a covenant with America. All right?
Now, once again, you see basically the game that's being played with these Negro leaderships that our power is in the Creator and in each other. He had to throw the Creator bit in, you know, the hocus pocus it. And this is after he's got through saying that our problem is that we let other folks take the spiritual high ground. Now, if you consider Boy George and these other enemies taking some kind of spiritual high ground, who basically are immorally plundering the world, then I'm scared of your spirituality, because it's clear that you've made a pact with someone who wears hooves. and walks around on hooves and stuff and has two horns coming from his head. Look, this Negro leadership, they're kind of like a petty gang throughout South Central LA. They have all of these different fractions, different little setups, so on and so forth. The Crips have a bunch of sets. The Bloods have all of their sets. When you go through East LA, there's a bunch of sets that, you know. Now, they're all on Massa's plantation. None of them own the streets or control anything. And they're all vibing for little respectability and power within their particular sets and the blocks that they live on. But they have no real social economic control. And they know they never will because of the way things are set up. This is the way these so-called fake leaders are. They're not trying to expropriate the ruling class from its power base. As a matter of fact, the Andrew Youngs and all of them want to just be absorbed within it. That's how Andrew Young and them end up being spokesmen for Nike. Here's someone who is embedded in the whole civil rights struggle, yet he goes off and helps wash over the horrendous things that are actually happening to, you know, women in Indonesia and stuff like that, that who are being brutalized by the U.S. empire. That's considered a success amongst these Negro type leaderships and stuff. And that helps expose what they really have to offer.
Nothing. In fact, when you hear these Negro preachers start talking about morality, put your hand over your pocket. You understand that? When Bill Cosby went off and started talking negative, just spewing negative stereotypes about poor black people on national television, supposedly airing dirty laundry. Actually, what he had to say was, for the most part, not all that actually accurate, you know? Nevertheless, in spite of the fact there was no factual basis to his remarks, it did not stop the legion of black misleaders that have weighed in on his remarks. And those misleaders include Jesse Jackson, NAACP President Kwasi Nfume, some members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and a horde of black commentators stumbling all over themselves to hail Cosby as the ultimate truth giver. Now, I'm going to tell you, I'll give you a specific on this moral stuff and show you why we can't play these games, these Negro preacher games here. Well, here's one of Cosby's myths. Let's just take one simple one. Cosby said publicly, and I quote this, "You've got to stop," I guess he's supposed to be addressing black men here, "you've got to stop beating up your women because you can't find a job and you want to get an education and now you're minimum wage." Well, here's the truth. You know, it's not clear what bed and living rooms in poor black households Cosby is peeping into when he makes such ridiculous statements. But a Justice Department study in the year 2000 found that since 1993, domestic violence plunged among all racial groups. It further found that the murder rate of black females killed by their partners sharply dropped, while the murder rate jumped among white females killed by their partners. The Justice Department study in the UCLA School of Public Health study in 1996, however, found that blacks are more likely to report domestic violence than whites, Hispanics, and Native Americans, which, you know, may affect statistics in some way. So here you go. This is the quality of leadership we're getting. Bill Cosby makes a ridiculous stereotype remark, Negroes jump on the bandwagon. And was it at all useful? Did it help to inspire black people to correct real problems that we do have? Hell no. We need a fighting program that points the way forward in our struggle for survival and liberation. Not a whole lot of half-baked stereotypes that we already know.
Unfortunately, we ran right out of time again, like normal. there were other speakers who were about to step up to the mic. One of them included a Farrakhan. And it's hard to visualize and see a Farrakhan on the mic talking about black leadership and what black leadership needs to, where it needs to go, when this is the same man who called for the death of Malcolm X, saying that such a man as Malcolm is worthy of death. The mere fact that Farrakhan is sitting up there talking about what needs to be done, and Malcolm is laying in a coffin, says a lot about what that whole thing and where that whole thing and what it's all about. This is some sick stuff. The December 4th, 1964 article in Muhammad Speaks, Louis Farrakhan says, quote, such a man as Malcolm is worthy of death. And that Malcolm is a hypocritical dog. Malcolm is a hypocritical dog. Huh. Somebody is watching these leaders, so-called leaders. And when the time is right, it's clear we're going to have to do more than just watch. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.
All the time.